The 1997 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 326, I Know Beyond a Shadow of a Doubt, Testimonies of Gay Men, with Robert J. Christensen, Ben Jarvis, Dwayne Altig, and Stephen Zacharias.
If we may begin now. This is a very typical meeting, you know, you can't, what do you have to do?
I guess we need an organ player to call everybody's attention to. But then Mormons speak through prelude music anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So, this morning, we want, at least the topic is, let's call it, I call it gay testimonies. And it's the idea, if I may read from the little blurb I wrote, men and women who are attracted to others of the same sex have been unthinkingly demonized by parts of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Others are discovering that a deep and vital spirituality lives on in the lives of many gay men and lesbian women, especially among gay and lesbian Mormons. The institutional church may have marginalized some Mormons attracted to others of the same sex, but gospel values still inspire many gay and lesbian saints to lead more Christ-like lives. That was the topic. And as I went to put the panel together, I don't live in Utah, I live up in the Northwest, and so most of my contacts are internet contacts, and, you know, somebody in Washington and somebody in California, and so it was easy to find people who were interested, but it was hard to find people who were able to get from there to here, especially when many will be returning to Salt Lake in 2 weeks for the National Affirmation Conference. And so two round-trip tickets for a lot of people was just more than they could bear. And but we have myself today. Here we have Ben Jarvis and two other people who had said they were anticipating being here couldn't, and I would like to tell you a little bit about both, so the situation. Let me start with Steve Zacharias. He's one of the founders of Affirmation many years ago. And he's a man who, when he was very, very young, was raised by his deaf grandparents for the first 11 years of his life. And so his first language is sign language. Excuse me, for deaf people. And he served a mission, worked with some deaf people during his mission. Then after his mission, married. He was a bishop for several months. And eventually came to realize, or I would prefer to use the word acknowledge, that his attractions were not to his wife. He loved his wife for what it was worth, but there were no attractions there. Somebody yesterday had used the phrase, he said, you know, I love my wife, she loved me, but it was killing me inside. And we both realized that there had to be some release from this relationship. And Zach has been very active in a number of things. He's been working at the University of Utah in their deaf services. To find religious expression of his beliefs, he's been asked several years ago to go and sign for one of the Catholic churches in the city for their Sunday services. And most recently, he has been asked by the Diocese of New York to come back and work with their deaf services. He's actually been asked to be the kind of, they decided they want to have to run a class for the training of deaf priests, and so he's been asked to be the kind of the go-between, the signer for their seminary training. I tell you this because I'm struck, in a sense, I feel a sense of tragedy. Why are we losing somebody who is talented like this because of the fact that he turns to others of the same sex to find a sense of intimate completion? We're losing people like that. I was guessing we're probably losing in the neighborhood of 1,000 gay men a year. Really positive, talented people because of these things. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about a second person that I know only by the internet, well, one or two telephone calls. There was a young man on a gay Mormon list, Q Saints, who posted a list, posts, and the subject was, the bishop is calling me into his office, what should I say? And he had written several posts with this topic, and it was discussed a little bit. And I'm like, here's somebody that would be a good person to have on the panel. I wonder if he would come. And so I emailed him, and I got back. I like the idea, but what would I say? I'd like to read you several posts here. I feel you may want to hear a story of my spirituality or how I have reconciled my spirituality with my sexuality. Here was somebody who had said he'd been inactive for a number of years, but he was going back to church because he had spiritual yearnings that he needed to have responded to. I grew up in Portland, graduated from PSU in economics. I have a wonderfully supportive family and a lover of 7 years. I work as an information specialist for a health consulting firm. I would be glad to share more with you. I don't know if I will be able to make it to Salt Lake City. I would sure love to. I will have to check with my family if I'm able to make it to Salt Lake. What do we do from here? I've written a little about my testimony in my journal. If you might create a typical outline, I might be able to put something together. What should the length be? And he wrote this to me at 6:45 in the evening. Less than an hour later, I'll be able to get my hands on a ticket. I just need to get some logistics. I don't have any friends in Salt Lake City, so where is a cheap place to stay that will be near this place and what never? Then, through computer problems on my part, I was unable to get in touch with him for about 10 days. I wrote him. No answer. Through the wonders of the internet, I got his telephone number. Actually, he'd given me his telephone number, and I called, and there was this very strange voice of, well, he's away. Well, this is where he lives, I think. Well, sometimes, well, this is the phone number he gave me as his home. Well, would you tell him I called and I'm really looking for him? Yeah. And I sent another email off to him. Nothing came back. Called again, and I got the answering machine with a different voice on it. And then I waited till Monday morning, called again at his work phone and talked to him. Gee, it sounds an awful lot like the voice that I spoke to before who said he wasn't home. And he just told me, he said, I'm sorry, I can't make it, I can't come. And then, when was it? The next day, a series of 3 or 4 posts came over the Q Saints. And if I've got them right, in the right order, I'd like to read them to you. And I'm a little bit afraid in the reading I might break down, because I find it, when I think about it, it's tragedy. This is a post by Dwayne. Someone wrote to Dwayne, and then his response. I have decided I do not want to continue being a Mormon. In the bishop's interview, the bishop called me a, quote, son of Satan, quote, I am breaking every commandment found in the Bible, Book of Mormon, and DNC, that people like me deserve stoning and AIDS. Anyway, I could go on. I told him, thank you for your time, and finished my meeting. After talking with my family and friends, I've decided that to go back would mean I would have to fight too much. I went to Dignity, a gay Catholic group meeting. Gay couples were sitting arm in arm. I was refreshed. I'm going to close the book on my Mormon background. I feel my spiritual life can be nurtured elsewhere. A friend in Boise wrote him, Dear Dwayne, I'm so sorry to hear about your experience. It was almost to be predicted, but maybe not as harsh as you experienced. I don't want to seem to defend the Mormon Church, as I'm disenchanted at the moment, too, but isn't Dignity to the Catholic Church as affirmation is to the Mormon Church? In other words, I don't think you'll see gay couples arm in arm at Catholic Church either. I don't suppose that there is an affirmation group in D.C., however. Maybe I'm wrong, and they do have services at Dignity. Dwayne had added a note here. Yes, they do. I wish that some affirmation chapters would start gay-lesbian branches like the people of Ammon did when they were cast out of their churches in the Book of Mormon. And then the friend continues, Anyway, with your positive attitude, you've been an asset to Q Saints. Q Saints is the name of the gay Mormon internet list. I wish you'd let the rest know what happened to you, but regardless, good luck, my friend, and best wishes for the future. Dwayne wrote the following. Thank you for your message. My purpose for going back to church was because I felt I was missing God in my life. I have told a few of the closeted members of the ward of my meeting with the bishop and my decision to take my spiritual journey elsewhere. I am thankful for the meeting I had with the bishop. I feel I got a wake-up call from God through the bishop. After all I've been taught in church, prejudice rules the heart of the LDS leadership, in my humble opinion, and that is not how I want to grow spiritually. I had a closeted member over last night for dinner, and we were talking about being gay and Mormon. It is my opinion that he has compartmentalized his life. It is my partner's opinion that he is in store for a rude awakening, and that I used to be just like him. My partner says I would look through my rose-colored glasses and not see the total beauty of life because I couldn't deal with the truth if it didn't fit within my predefined structure as dictated from the church authorities. I don't want to live like that. I'm not saying by any means that this is how Mormons live. I am saying this is how I lived as a Mormon, and this is how I and my partner see this gentleman living. I have learned that the true church does not exist within some doctrine or institution, but in one's personal relationship with God. There has been a great book I've been reading lately that has greatly helped me open my eyes. It is called The Orthodox Church by Timothy Ware. My partner Waldo comes from the Catholic tradition. He calls himself a bingo Catholic. That's an interesting phrase. He says that means the Orthodox. He says that means I believe the message, but not the messenger. My spiritual walk has now taken me in another direction. I feel now Waldo and I should be able to sit in a church service together, hand in hand, and enjoy the spirit of the community. It is our purpose to grow spiritually together. For now, we may find it at a mass sponsored by Dignity or Axos. I wish you the best of luck. That is why Dwayne is not here. I say this just happened. This was what? Those posts were this Tuesday, 3 or 4 days ago. A couple more words of introduction, if I may, and a word of warning. Please do not presume that because a brother or sister is prepared to respond to the noun gay or lesbian, please do not presume that you know anything about that person's sexual behavior. Very, very dangerous. Being gay does not mean you're celibate, nor does it mean you're promiscuous. It means merely that a person finds his deepest sense or her deepest sense of fulfillment and completion in another of the same sex. Yesterday, one gay man spoke of his real and abiding love for his wife. But that level of deepest intimacy that often results in the physical union of two people, that possibility was not open to him. He said that that was causing a slow death, but one which would nevertheless come in the next year or two. He knew it, and she knew it, and they talked frequently. They talked about it numerous times, and they finally decided that the only way out was to divorce, so that both might seek other partners with whom each could find true intimacy. Divorce would not be selfish, but the ultimate selflessness. This is one comment that Boyd K. Packer often talks about. It's selfish, it's selfish. No, in a sense, it's being unselfish. I'm surprised at the number of, have to keep it to men. Gay Mormon men that I've met, and I'm not really, living up in the Northwest, I'm not really in circulation to meet a lot, but I'm surprised at the number of men who have spoken very deeply of their love and affection for their wives. And we don't really have a language to talk about that kind of love now, where you feel you've got to, both people in a sense, they love each other, but that final completion is not there. And to allow each person to get that or work towards that final completion, divorce came. And so we just don't have a way to talk about it. Divorce would not be selfish, but the ultimate selflessness. And it would give their several children the kind of loving parents they all deserved. Being gay means that you're attracted to others of the same sex. That attraction may, and in many or most cases, does lead to some kind of physical expression, but is not necessarily sexual. So we must be careful that because somebody says he's gay, we know what he does. That's not necessarily the case. So please be careful and do not presume you know with whom or how often anybody sleeps with somebody else of the same sex. If they say they're gay or lesbian, it's very dangerous. Or bisexual or transsexual. We do have a few transsexuals in the church. The last comment is testimonies are ultimately personal. The key word is the first person singular, I. This is a testimony that really expresses how I make sense of things individually. It can focus very much on the individual senses, the individual readings. They can be very quirky. I don't know if any of you maybe remembered or read of it. Some years ago, Dialogue published a long poem by David Wright. Is it called Patriarch of the River, perhaps? And it was about a I was an old man, maybe 65, 70 years old, up in Idaho, and David had met him and talked to him, and he was, in effect, bearing the testimony of his life, and it was strange. The first time I read it, I thought, this is dumb. And I was at Taiwan at the time going to a district leadership conference. I carried my copy along with me, and I read it that night again, and all of a sudden it left me in tears, just this, the quirkiness of this man's testimony. And I think for most of us, once we get past the learned discourse of sacrament and testimony, fast and testimony meetings, and it is a learned discourse, once we get past that and start to, I believe, you know, you could almost have a recorder at the front of the chapel, and the bishop just pushes it and changes a few words and changes the tone of the voice. And once we get past that, we're really dealing with real individual testimonies. What makes sense to me, to Ben, to every one of you, what makes sense is how has God affected our lives? And this is the thing to which we bear witness. Gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered Mormons, in some ways we do live on the boundary of the church, marginal of the church, we're somewhat marginalized. But it's important, I think, to remember that there is great spiritual life there and great spiritual truth, I think, we can learn from it. It may not be conventional. I know mine is not very conventional. Ben has faxed me and said, you know, gee, I don't know if would I fit or what. Let me tell you a little bit about Ben and then let him talk, and then I'll conclude if I can. Should I read your introduction that you wrote?
Sure. I can't remember what I wrote, but that's probably a good place to start.
Well, he said, you know, you may use your editorial skills. And Ben Jarvis, Affirmation member. For those of you who don't know, there are any, Affirmation is the gay and lesbian group of Mormons. Affirmation member and currently a member of the board of directors. Excuse me, my mouth's getting very dry. Board of members for Affirmation Los Angeles. Ben handles, I like the way you're talking, you're third person here. Ben handles chapter outreach and is also one of the three people listed in the Affirmation National Information Line. Ben is a long-range transportation planner in Orange County. Is that still the case? Or
Until next Thursday.
He has a new job and is in the process of moving, so we're kind of doubly honored that...
To a more conservative area. Because Orange County was hard enough.
The other marvelous thing about it is here is just the sense of dependability. He said he would come, and he got here. That makes the panel organizers very grateful. Ben is a long-range transportation planner in Orange County, has been in California. He's also an active member of the Southern California, this is his passion, the Southern California scuba diving community, and is a member of one of the largest gay and lesbian scuba clubs in the nation. Now, let me just tell you one other thing, related thing. This is actually, today's the first day we've ever actually met. Although we've corresponded on the net, not terribly much, but off and on for a couple of years. One of the things that Ben does is, I'm not even sure which it is. Where do you get these kooky messages? Is it a homepage?
Which kooky messages can be more specific? There's so many.
Anyway... I will assume for the moment that it's a Los Angeles Affirmation chapter homepage. And because it's a homepage on the internet, you key in the computer and the search engine finds it and he gets people. This is mixed company, and even in a mixed company, I wouldn't want to repeat some of the messages that you've gotten. And Ben takes a lot of time to write good, thoughtful, positive responses back. Messages from kooky old men who have nothing better to do than sound like truck drivers. But then other young people who are maybe in their late teens. I don't know how many are ever exploring their sexuality, but people, you know, this can't happen in the Mormon church, and Ben will write and understanding, trying to increase the understanding of people. Also, he has been an active I hope we can say that here. I've never been an active participant in the third Friday meeting. I've never been there because I don't live there. In the Los Angeles Stake, I think it is.
Yes.
For some years, the Stake president, or then Stake president, I think he's been replaced now, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Has held a meeting on the third Friday of every month, specifically for the gay and lesbian community in his stake. There's one story that's told about it. He was getting a little bit of pressure. How could the stake president hold this kind of meeting? And it was being held in a chapel, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, we meet in the Westwood Chapel, directly behind the LA Temple.
And how could you hold this meeting in the chapel? And so the stake president, I just heard this recently, he said, well, then we'll hold it in my house, my home. But then in another exchange, when he was being pressured, I presume by an area president, basically told him, okay, you tell me that I'm no longer spiritually responsible for these people and I won't minister to them. But until it was put like that, he was expected to be responsible for these people, but not to be, what do you call it, to not be responsible for them. And Ben, he's been in the center of a lot of good activities, and I think he will have a great deal of interesting things to tell us today. If he's responding to all these kooky messages, maybe it'll be a little kooky. I think it'll probably just good, hard sense and experience. Ben.
Thanks.
Yes.
We've got this thing. Great, keeps falling off.
Is this good? Can everyone hear me?
You know what?
Oh, it's better for me. These tables aren't built for tall people. This panel today really intrigued me, and I'm even more intrigued now that I'm the only one here.
I'm here.
Okay, I stand corrected. I think, you know, I'd like to start off by saying, for most people in the church, at least from my perspective, and I could be wrong, we go through our lives with a prescribed spiritual paradigm. It's taught to us starting when we're very young. And for many LDS people, that model works. And I know that that was the case for me, or at least it was a model that I tried to make work and tried to fit. Unfortunately, like many other gay Latter-day Saints or former Latter-day Saints, there came a time in my life where I had to basically concede that the person that I was did not fit that LDS model, and that I had to re-examine my options. Now, when you're born and raised in the church, that's a very scary proposition, because if you're not Mormon, then what are you? You know, and for me, my family goes all the way back to the church's founding. It's been a long struggle, but it's been well worth the effort. For me, aside from all of the sexuality issues and the realizations there, I guess for me, spiritually, the separation started back in 1991 when I made a trip to Oregon to see my grandfather and grandmother. Now, since I grew up in Southern California and my grandparents were in Eastern Oregon, I didn't have the opportunity to see them as much as some people see their grandparents. So this was a unique opportunity for me to actually get to know my grandma and grandpa. And when I went out there, my grandfather and I had a discussion. And he's a farmer. In fact, we always joked and said the grandpa could make water run uphill. And he passed away last year, so I'm really glad I had the chance to get to know him. But as I was talking with him, he mentioned his feelings about the church. And, you know, don't get me wrong, he had nothing against the church. He enjoyed the church. He was very active until the day that he died. However, he was talking with me back in 91, and he said, you know, Ben, we have the temple, we have the sacrament, you know, service, we have all the church programs, and those are nice, those are okay. But for me, my spirituality comes when I'm working out in the garden, and I plant seeds, and I watch them grow, and I watch them produce fruit that can feed people, and this entire cycle of life that just continues, you know, and all you have to do is provide, you know, the sunshine and the water, and the rest takes care of itself. Why was I surprised? I mean, grandfather was a profound man. But I went back and I wrote that down in my journal, and that conversation has stayed with me all these years and actually means much more to me now than it did then. If you fast forward a few years, back in 1995, at this point, I had just graduated from UC Irvine, finished up my master's degree, and I had started my coming out process. I'd gone through the social services program, if you can call it that. It was more of a joke. And unfortunately, it's a program that I would have bought into if I had been 10 years younger, you know, and actually trying to follow the church's teachings and looking to Salt Lake to validate my every move. But in 1995 was different. I'd already come out, and just as background there, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent, but my coming out process was very different, thankfully, than most people's. It was easy for me. I went home for dinner one Sunday, and my mom sat down and said, you know, we keep waiting for you to come out, and we're tired of it, so, you know, we're the parents of a gay son, and as soon as he accepts himself and starts living his life like, you know, he thinks that he should, you know, well, I'll be happier for it, which isn't bad coming from a woman who was Relief Society president, and the fact that Dad was the bishop, well, makes for interesting conversations around the dinner table. But I need to tell you that because I didn't have the issues with the family that a lot of people do. I never had to worry about being cast out or being cut off. In that context, in 1995, I was called into the Irvine Stake president's office and was told that, at first I thought he was joking when he told me that some sisters in the ward felt that they were in competition with me and the other gay members for the elders. And I started to laugh, and then I realized that, no, he's actually quite very serious. Oh, well, you know. But that started a conversation that lasted about 90 minutes. And in that conversation, that president, although, I mean, I'll still call him a good man, because I don't think just because he carries around some prejudice and bigotry in one sector of his life means that he's totally of non-value in the other sectors. That's certainly not true. But in that 90 minutes, I found that I was on the hot seat and that I was being called to justify my feelings. And this was a man that didn't know church policy. You know, I knew what the policy was. And as a recommend holding tithe paying ward member, being told that that wasn't good enough and that Irvine was a stake for families and that they didn't want to send the wrong impression and think that gay people were actually welcome there. Which, again, kind of goes against the church policy, which I think makes it very clear that there, you know, homosexuality by itself is not inherently sinful, that sin only occurs when someone acts on those feelings. You know, referencing back to the Ensign article back in 1995. That's where I had to make a choice. I knew that if I remained in Irvine, it would only be a matter of time before church action was taken against me. I was censured. I was placed under an obligation to not speak of my homosexuality to anyone or to speak of the Los Angeles Third Friday meeting, which was kind of strange to me because, believe me, it wasn't like I was wearing a sandwich board to church saying, hello, I'm gay, you know. But what I didn't have to say, the Mormon grapevine said quite well. The thing that struck me about that, too, that I think was fairly tragic, was that was the Irvine Singles Ward. Orange County, California, Irvine's not a cheap place to live. You had a lot of singles who had college degrees, doctors, dentists, lawyers, business people. Single, upper 30s, I mean, certainly not all of them were gay. You know, there were a lot of reasons people were single, but homosexuality was a major reason. Some of you are familiar with the book Born That Way. That was born out of the Irvine 7th Ward. The people who were involved in putting that together came out of the Irvine 7th Ward, which made it very interesting for me and a few other people when we came out. Some of the people that compiled the background research for Born That Way came after us saying, oh, here's a book, you need to read it. Okay, great. Read it. It's a data point. But that started my journey, I want to say outside of the church, but that's really not the case. It just caused me more than at any other time in my life to say, you know, what is it that I actually believe? What is it that I like about the Mormon community? What is it that I can take with me? And again, fortunately, I was in an area of the country where affirmation was established. We have a strong chapter in LA. And I had the good fortune of being able to continue into my life and be able to associate with Mormon friends in the Mormon community. The LA stake, I think, has it together on the issue. And I don't want to make it sound like they're overly gay-friendly because they're not. They're more gay-friendlier than other stakes in the church, certainly. But this Third Friday group has been a very educational experience for both parties involved, those of us on the gay in the gay community as well as those in the church community. And it's been a very stressful and tenuous relationship at times. But what I've been able to take from this is that I know who I am, and I'm very comfortable in my Mormon roots. There are a lot of Mormon traditions that I still take great comfort in. If I were to be hit by a bus tomorrow, and, you know, let's face it, I do work for the bus company, so that's, you know, a definite possibility. I would have a Mormon funeral. I really look forward to that. Well, I mean, not in the near future. But you catch my drift. When one of my family members dies, you know, I'll be there to dress them in their temple clothes. I'll be buried in mine. I hope to stand in the circles, you know, if I have the opportunity when my nieces or nephews are blessed. I know that if I was going in for an operation, I'd want my dad and want my brother to come up to LA and give me a blessing, you know. And not only that, I'd want some of my close friends, whether or not they're still members of the church or not, to be there and to participate in that ordinance. And I need to make it clear that to me that's a cultural thing, that, you know, I've left a lot of the Salt Lake ideology behind, but to me that's a very Mormon thing to do, and I still take great comfort from that. To tie this back together to what I started with about the story with my grandfather and gardening, as Robert said, I'm an avid scuba diver, and those of us in Barnacle Busters, which is the Gay and Lesbian Dive Club of Southern California, we do a lot of fun activities, and it's a great group of people. I'm one of several Mormons that are involved in that, and we're always trying to look for more, you know, missionary spirit.
Call recruit.
Missionary spirit. To me, when I feel closest to God or the higher power is when I actually get to go out and play in the kelp forest. I was out off the coast of Southern California last weekend. We had a class out there, and to see the students' faces light up when the first sea lion swims up to them, or to see the beauty of the kelp forests for the first time. There's nothing that I can say that could explain that. The only way to experience it is to actually get out there in the kelp forest and dive down about 40 feet and see it for yourself. That, to me, is when I realize that, you know, there is a greater force at work, and that, you know, as a human being, we have a responsibility, you know, to protect the environment, to look out for other species. And a corollary to that is that we need to look out for ourselves and our fellow humans, you know, back on the surface. And that simply strengthened the bond that I have with my grandfather, and it also strengthens, you know, the bonds that I have spiritually, both to the church and to the past that I found without the church. So that's my experience.
I'm just old enough, my mind seems to be going more and more senile, and I look at you and say, you look a little older than I am by a couple of years, and I'd like some lessons in remaining alert. I had been working on a paper for this, and I had actually kind of written half, and then I had notes that I'd tack together as a guideline to the rest of it. I'd like, if I could, to read you just a few passages here and there in it. One of the things that I had in mind here was that we get really differences of kind of perceptions of how the gospel is striking us. Because I know, as near as I can see in the gay and lesbian Mormon community, there are just lots and lots of differences. But there's a lot of real vital spirituality there. I don't know if you've heard of the group. There's a group called Gamma Fight, Gay Mormon Fathers. It's a very strange group. At times, it appears to operate with no leadership whatever. But there is one of the leaders, the national leaders, is in the back row. But it has a quality of being very locally based, if you want. There's an attempt to coordinate all the groups, but it's a group in California, a group in Utah, a group in the East Coast. Have they done one in the Chicago area, Midwest? Yeah. This December, late January, early February, I've forgotten, there was the first group meeting in the Northwest area. And it's usually a 2 or 3 day like a retreat, and where people go off, pretty much gay Mormon fathers, a few of us like myself who've never been married or invited, kind of honorary Gamma Fights, I guess, and go off and exchange introductions to themselves. There's a certain amount of fun, risque play, which would be open to vast misinterpretation if you didn't know the people who are involved in it. It's really delightful fun, and the Sunday morning always ends with a kind of, well, I should say maybe always, but often ends with a kind of a spiritual meeting, and it's very, very rich and moving, I found myself. Let me read just a little bit now. In many ways, I'm white on the outside, but yellow on the inside. Born and raised in the United States, mellowed a bit in France and Switzerland, I've grown old in Asia. I lived for several months in Kyoto, Japan, loved a year or so in Hong Kong, and profited from over 26 years in Taiwan. It has left me something very strange, a gay Taoist Mormon. For many, this is a contradiction in terms. But for me, I find deep inner harmonies in apparent contraries, harmonies which both affirm my same-sex attractions and my faith and hope that Christ will inform my behavior. Let me try to explain first the yellow, then the white. I'm just going to skip most of the yellow if I can. Here, when I was talking about it, I was talking about a couple of lessons. One, probably the most important lesson that I got out of my adventure into Taoism was just things are what they are. Not what they should be or ought to be, but things are what they are. And Taoism tells us to pay attention to what things are. Not what you want them to be, but what they are. And in Taoism, one of the worst possible words is the word should. Now, that doesn't mean you become complacent, but it means to pay attention to what you are and to look for ways for that are-ness to grow and expand. Second thing with Taoism that you learn is we stop talking about being and start to talk more and more about becoming. So what you are right now is at best something fleeting. 30 seconds from now, you're something already different. Now, hopefully it will grow out of what you are now. And so you're never constrained by what you are now, but you're told to be faithful. If you wanted counsel, to be faithful, to let it grow out of that. And that I have found very meaningful to myself as a gay man, because it says, don't try to change things, don't try to rip things out, but learn to, express them well. Now, a little aside, it'll sound a little bit catty, but I've learned a great deal from it. There's another gay Mormon list. I think they would probably hate the word gay. Another list called Disciples. I was a member of Disciples for about a year, then they excommunicated me. I'm still not quite sure why. I think because I would occasionally, I was like taking a mouse and occasionally let a mouse down in the middle of the thing and watch everybody go, eh! This is a group of people who are trying faithfully, that's not a good word for it, are trying doggedly to remain faithful to their covenants. There are people that will admit that they're attracted to others of the same sex. It's mostly a male group. Q Saints is also mostly a male group, but we do have a few women on the group. They admit they're attracted to others of the same sex, but by damn it, they're not going to do anything. And it's the most depressing group I've ever been with. One, I admire, there's a certain cohesiveness. The earlier panel we had in this room, they talked a little bit about a sense of community. And affirmation is very good at creating a sense of community. The internet is being wonderfully effective for that, because here I'm in a town where I know of one or two other gay Mormons, but they're, past tense, very, very much so. But I'm relating to people in Portland. I'm relating to people in New York City. I'm relating to Ben down in the Bay Area. The internet allows us to do that, creates a marvelous new kind of cyber community, if I want. But Disciples creates a very important community. I hope that's not the Disciples spy. I'll be dead for sure. But they get together, and it becomes... people talking about, well, I sewed my lamé dress. Well, can I buy your lamé dress when I go here? And exchanging recipes. And one day, in just pure frustration, the list owner is a woman attracted to another woman, she had a relationship, and she just canceled the relationship. Called up and says, we're not going to be related anymore. And... after that, I had spoken to the other partner in Washington at the time. She says, it's funny, you know, we broke up, and we've been on the phone every day since then. she's not a member of the church, the other partner, but I once told her, I said, I have the impression that this list is very much like, it reminds me of a group of 7 and 8 year olds walking around with their Woolworth bought chaps and their cap guns having shootouts at the OK Corral. It's the most infantile list I have actually ever been around. Now, I've always been, Bob, can't you be a little bit younger? 20 years ago, I took a test in Reader's Digest about maturity, and at that time, I came out being 88. Something's wrong with the test, or me, I don't know what. There's a quality of maturity, and this is people who are not really prepared to face who they are. Now, one of the problems, a real problem we have here, I don't know if being same-sex attracted is in my genes. I don't know if it's, I really don't suspect it's in the training, entirely cultivated. There's one man that's very interesting. What's his name? Is it Bynes? Barnes, Dr.?
Bynes.
Bynes. That the social services people liked very, very much, because he challenged the idea of, well, it's in your place in the very, very first months of your birth. And he uses the comparison of a bird. He said, if you take, for example, a canary and put it in a nest of robins, a just-born canary, the canary will end up singing like a robin. But after a few weeks, you take him and put him back in the nest of canaries, and he'll never sing like a canary. There's something that happens in the brain, in the patterning, if you want, the structuring of the brain, the experiences. His experience is the sounds of robins, not the sounds of canaries, and that patterns his ability to sing. And that's what he believes. And, if you sat and thought about it, it's the exact opposite of anything the LDS, SS. What a wonderful name for that. I can't say that without smirking. It's just impossible for me. Anyway, these things happen, that the sense of they're not prepared to be who they are. And one of the things I learned in Asia was, be who you are. You can cultivate certain things, but there's certain things that you don't cultivate. And all of you, for example, a bonsai tree, for example. How do you make a bonsai tree? Have you ever looked at one closely? You take the thing and you take good, hard, like wire. You take a branch and you wire it into shape, and it grows a little bit, then you wire it a little bit more. So it looks beautiful. But if you look really closely, all you can see is the constraints of that wire around it. And at least one of the things I learned in Asia is to look for, we say, natural beauties. But to me, I can't look at a bonsai plant anymore and see beauty in it, because I know that it's crippled, is what it is. And this is one of the things that I learned in Asia. And there are several more. I was also very fortunate I came out when I was in Asia, which meant I didn't have to deal directly with my family. I didn't have to deal too much with the church, because I was the token foreigner in a large Taiwan branch. And being a foreigner in the Taiwan branch, especially an American foreigner and a returned missionary, that kind of put me on it's almost like being a visiting authority kind of level. And so that freed up things a lot, but it didn't solve a lot of problems. It's interesting, Ben can talk about his family, the receptivity of his family. I hope there's nobody around here right now, but I have exactly the opposite problem. When my mother got a copy of, she got a copy of this program and saw my name on it, and when I called her up and asked if I could stay, come and stay for a week or two, visit for a couple of weeks, I basically got told I was not welcome. It has now been extended, so I'm getting to stay 3 nights. I've done my 3 nights, and I'm wondering if I'm going to have to be looking for another place to live tonight. But it's the kind of thing, you know, as long as you don't bring it home. You can be gay in Oregon, but don't be gay in Salt Lake City. Just the disaster kind of takes over. Usually, I found she was, like, very grim the first day, and the third or fourth day she starts to relax a little bit and realize anew that I'm not a dragon. I'm not going up and down the State Street and attacking boys. And when I get in the car occasionally at night and drive into town, is it KUER, the radio station? They've usually had a very wonderful jazz program in the evening. And I love to just get in the car, as my mother lives out on holiday, and just drive into town, make a circle, and drive home. It's the most wonderful, quiet evening. I'm not a great jazz fan, but that's just what a wonderful thing. And I'm sure she thinks I'm driving into town and hunting up the bars and having a wild time. And it could not be anything different, any more different. But these perceptions kind of just linger on and grow on. Now, let me go on a little bit further, if I may, here. I'm not a naturally spiritual man. Few things are harder than forcing myself to my knees to pray. For prayer, I substitute a kind of generic prayerfulness. But I recognize that it lacks the concentration and focus that real prayer would bring me. Nevertheless, I struggle onward, weak but still trying to embody in my life and conduct the precious truths and insights, the light that the gospel of Jesus Christ has brought me. To the truthfulness of that light, I bear witness. I want to go on talking a little bit about Joseph Smith, where it comes to Joseph Smith. When a friend told me we must, I do not tend to turn to spiritual explanations. When a friend told me we must have known each other in the pre-existence, I thought, by Jove, he's right. But I myself would never in 1,000 years have thought of that as an explanation for the immediacy with which we became fast friends. It's just not in my mental vocabulary until he spoke forth. There have been times when I have felt the Holy Ghost's swift kick in the derriere, and there have been other times when he's touched my soul and confirmed the truthfulness of things. But mostly I'm still a man of the world, a man of words, one who values the witness of the Spirit, who nevertheless wants to think out things for himself as much as possible. Again and again I recall verses in the 46th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. To some it is given by the Holy Ghost to know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that he was crucified for the sins of the world. To others it is given to believe on their words, that they might also have eternal life if they continue faithful. The Holy Ghost has taught me that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that he was crucified for our sins. But I confess now that I am more a man of words, believing more on the words of others. But I'm captivated by the experience and the example of Christ. I rejoice in the life and calling of Joseph Smith, the prophet, seer, and revelator. I rejoice because he brought together heaven and earth, God and man. I cannot speak for the Jewish faith, but traditional Christianity has posited a complete and unbridgeable gap between man and God. That gap might maximize the awe with which I contemplate God, but it also makes him relatively irrelevant to my life. For the tradition, God is that which is beyond, behind existence. They even have something called negative theology, where anything you can say about God, God isn't. It's just by definition. You can't even talk about him. But I hail the prophet for having brought God as the Father in heaven back into a continuum with man and with me, for making him overwhelmingly relevant to me and my life. In college, I was a tenor in a quartet which sang some children's songs in state conference. One was, I am a child of God. How can he not love me, guide me, help me walk away? He who is, like Jesus the Christ, for me. Joseph brought him back into existence, so he is no longer a distant object of awe, but a near one of trust and love.
This I know neither as an act of cognition, nor by conventional Mormon personal revelation, but because I have tasted of its goodness. Tasted, a wonderful and insightful, if often forgotten, Book of Mormon phrase. And it's also one that Joseph uses in his King Follett discourse. A Book of Mormon metaphor, and the multiple meanings that are carried by goodness and tested of its truthfulness in my life. Being truthful, so much more important than knowing truth. I recently, preparing for this, reread the King Follett discourse, and I'm just marvel at the things he has to say. I'm not naturally very spiritual. Praying is hard for me, but big, dramatic, Cecil B. DeMille type spiritual experiencing does not play a big role in my life now, although I do remember that kind of experience. And if I am to be honest with myself, I must carry those experiences and their truths with me. They must be integrated into my life, my current life. Held captive by them? No. But who am I now? But who I am now must grow out of who and what I was and what I experience. I had here, when I wrote this, a comment to say, I love... Nobody, one person here will know who I'm talking about. Only two people will. I love Arlene and Carlin, but it is Susan who speaks most powerful to me of the spiritual things and points me to the ways that Christ might touch and transform our lives. I'm very sensitive to what people are teaching and bringing to me. Sometimes it gets me in trouble. There was a time many years ago when I studied closely an experience which spoke of teaching about the atonement to one who asked. And I think I happened to run onto a copy of that in the office of Boyd K. Packer. This has been one of the most wonderful, influential things in my life, and coming from a place I would not have expected it. And I remember committing to memory some of the passages in the Book of Mormon which spoke of Christ's love, of his willingness to pay the price, and of his paying in vain if I did not repent by becoming more than I had been. I no longer remember those passages word for word, but they continue to exist as seminal influences in my life, less as proof texts than, I hope, as an embodied attitude towards others. I can't remember the words, but the ideas are just, they're implanted, if you want, in my brain, the way I see things. The Book of Mormon passages focus on the atonement as a kind of weighing of my shortcomings and of Christ compensating suffering, paying to balance the scales of justice. I do not disbelieve that, but what keeps pressing upon my mind, my spirit, is Christ is the one who was for others, even at risk to himself. I spoke or joined a panel at the Sunstone Symposium in San Jose, and we spoke about the atonement. And all I began with just the sentence, I'm a Mormon man whose life has been touched by the atonement. And it's touched in the way that Christ gives me, an example of how to live, of how to be for others. He was for others even at the risk and the cost of himself paying a price which he did pay. This reminds me, I have to put in a plug for the opposition here, of a statement by Boyd K. Packer. It's probably the least favorite man in this context in the whole church leadership. He was once talking about being called, and he said, you know, when we're called, we respond, we answer, we accept. And then he came on to a sentence that just stuck in my brain. If it costs, it costs. If I'm a president of the company and I'm called and I lose money, I respond and I just lose. It costs, period. And I've seen that kind of thing happen again and again in my life. I've lost every camera I've ever had. And every camera I have ever lost came from an act of being generous and helping and opening my life and my home to someone else. I should stop and think, well, gee, you know, you've been generous now. You've lost three cameras. Maybe it better be a little bit less. But if it costs, it costs. In a sense, what are the values that we place on being Christ-like? How much is too expensive? Now, I hope I can be a little bit more careful and put my camera away better next time. But still, this is the example that he sets for us. If it costs, it costs to be for others. Close with a little story. A year ago last September, I went to a conference held at the University of California, Berkeley. And the conference was, Human Sexuality and Religious Institutions. It was originally the first project of the Knudsen Foundation. The topic was human sexuality, but 80% of the conversation ended up, 70% ended up being about homosexuality in the church. Most people were Lutherans. One fellow from the university went with me, and Bonnie, who did the panel just before us, joined us for a while. The second evening after dinner, I was talking with a man who was I thought he was an evangelical. It turned out the next day he was an evangelical Episcopalian, and I'm still having trouble with that. Unusual mixture. And he was talking about, as it says in the scriptures, Christ says, all things are possible to him that believe. And talking with him, saying, but, there are certain things that to me don't seem to be possible. I know, I'm sure, Ben, how many gay men do you know who prayed and fasted and beat themselves up trying to change, and they didn't change? And on Disciples, somebody once posed the question, well, show us somebody who's changed. And the only one I can think of all the people on Disciples is somebody whose T-cell count was down to zero. And I think it's very easy to be celibate and change when you're in that. I shouldn't be quite so cynical, but I think you'll understand my point. Change. And so I've got to figure out ways to think of things. Well, the next day, the final day, we did what was called a marketplace of ideas. And everybody had a chance to write on a big piece of paper the topic they were interested in talking about. We pasted them on a big, schedule board. And then we would break into small groups and go and talk about these topics. I put up two topics. But this is a pretty liberal group, and I knew my evangelical Protestant was kind of unliberal. So I'm just, write something, talk. And I went over and talked to him, and we ended up talking through the whole morning and half of the afternoon, and I didn't get to my own two groups. But the thing that came to me when we talked, he kept talking about, the scriptures, the New Testament was important because it taught him about Jesus Christ. It was, in a sense, a testimony of Christ. And when I talked to him, the only thing I could keep coming back to was, to me, it wasn't the scriptures talked about Christ. It was, in a way, Christ talked about the scriptures. I believe in the New Testament because the power, the example of Christ that he sets for me is so powerful that compels my assent to try to live as best I can like Christ, to be Christ-like. And it is to that example, I bear witness. Now, when I was writing, next to the last paragraph here. The only question for me is not church membership, but whether or not I will be faithful to that to which I give my assent. Will I strive to embody in my life the examples, the models I have been given by Jesus Christ? One should not, however, assume that my embodying is anything more than an embarrassingly faint copy of that which I should be. There's my devil word. When you say what I can be, what I can become, I think that's in me. I have, not to be a good example, but a faint example. And it's embarrassing to think that it is such a faint copy. But it gives me some sympathy for Adam and Eve who hid in the bushes. I talked about Adam and Eve earlier in the paper that I had written. Now, how much time do we have left, or did I go over time? I'm sorry if I've gone over time. If you have any questions, I'm open. I'm sure Ben will. Do you have to run immediately?
My flight leaves tomorrow morning.
He's also been staying in Provo, though, so I don't know what he is. Thank you for coming and being with us today.